This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined, as always, by Bradley Chambers. Tonight, three sponsors for the show, the first being Jam Software, makers of ICT tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as Macs, iPads, iPhone, and Apple TV in education. More about them at jamsoftware.com. And by Shobi, an iPad app for paperless classrooms. Shobi makes it easy to assign, collect, and review student work, and to provide rich feedback with annotations, voice notes, and more. And finally, this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off, visit squarespace.com/outofschool and enter the offer code PUPIL at checkout. A better web starts with your website. Bradley, I'm back. How's it going?
Welcome home.
Thank you.
It's an exciting day.
Yeah, thank you for keeping the fort going while I was away. The good show last week with Matthew.
Well, it was. I think you tweeted while you were gone, you saw a demo with Jamp Software, how they were using iBeacons to create smart groups in the Casper suite. So mm-hmm. It was kind of timely.
Yeah, no, I'll tell you a little bit more about that during the show. That was one of the few things I saw last week that really I thought, yeah, okay, that was pretty cool, and I hadn't thought of that either. So I'll explain to you a little bit about how that was done in a while. But yeah, it's been an interesting week. I was spent the whole week at London doing different things. The Apple Leadership Summit was one part of it, and then we had a briefing in the Executive Briefing Center at Apple, and then Thursday, Friday, I was visiting the BET show and also speaking at it as well. So it was a good time.
Of course, this week we also saw the release of iOS 8.1.3, mm-hmm. which is particularly interesting for listeners of our show because of one last bullet point at the end. It says, adds new configuration options for education standardized testing. So we all start wondering, what is that? Well, and we'll have a link to the show notes on the Champ Nation forum. It says, they are four new options for disabling system-wide keyboard features that are problematic for testing. So dictionary, quick type, autocorrection, and spell check. So I imagine this is probably going to be something you would kind of control from Apple Configurator or from your MDM. So I imagine we'll have to see an update to those platforms to be able to do this.
Yep. I kind of guessed on Twitter that's what it was. I wasn't sure, and the notes don't say, but it's certainly something that every year at exam time, somebody emails me to ask, how do you make sure the spell checker is turned off and the dictionary is turned off? And hitherto, there were ways to do it, but it required you to basically have a spare iPad that you could wipe. And the way that you would do it is you can turn the spell checker off and then use gated access to prevent somebody turning it back on. But it wasn't really clear how to make sure the dictionary wasn't available. And the way that you would do that is you would have to erase the iPad completely. And then if you've never used the dictionary on iOS 7 or 8, there's no dictionary installed by default. You have to download whichever one you want the first time. So if the device has been completely erased and then it's off the network, you can't download a dictionary, therefore you can't use the dictionary. But for devices that have already been configured, that's a little bit more difficult to ensure. So I guess that's where these configuration options come in.
Well, it's just good to see this platform evolve. I mean, these are kind of edge case things that you don't think about in the beginning, but it's good to see that this is where they're all listening to feedback.
Yeah, most definitely.
We did see the release of Outlook for iOS today, which I immediately downloaded and installed and completely switched to, and I'm not kidding. It's a fantastic app.
Okay. It's an app that Microsoft acquired, is that right?
I think it's Accompli is how it's mm-hmm. pronounced. They acquired it last year, and they've rebranded it. And one of the things I do like is it integrates the calendar and email into one app. And, of course, the nice thing is it works with iCloud, Gmail, Outlook, Exchange, Yahoo. It works with all your usual suspects. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's also doing some mailbox app-style scheduling, so you're going to get those features. And it's got integration with Google Drive and Dropbox. So that's really, 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 really neat. I'm a big fan of it. Having some issues with the calendar so far, like I found two bugs where – my headmaster, he liked it and switched to it. He has about 10 calendars in Google, and one of them, two of them, I never could get turned on. Like, I would turn them on, I would leave the screen, and then they'll go back, and they'd still be off. Eventually, literally trying it 30 times, finally got them to stay on. And then I cannot figure out a way to create reoccurring calendar appointments in the app. So I sent us an email to support, had an email to support about another question. They've already gotten back to me, so it sounds like that they're on it. But big fan so far. I wish the fonts were a little bit different, but if you use Exchange and you've been wanting those mailbox style features of snoozing and you know, remind me about this tomorrow, this is a really, really nice app.
Mm-hmm. I particularly like the feature where you could, if you were doing an email where you're sort of offering somebody your availability, you could actually bring up your calendar view and you could tap in the empty areas and it would sort of assemble a list of those times that you had selected and put them into the email for you. I thought that was a feature that I hadn't really seen before, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, I like this new Microsoft, and it's, you know, Apple is in a similar place that Microsoft was with their applications, you know, maybe 10 years ago, where, mm-hmm. you know, Outlook, if you've ever worked in a Microsoft environment, I mean, people live in Outlook. They're obsessed with the calendars. I mean, it's all one big system. And if you're in that system, it works well. If everybody's in it and you're that kind of organization, because this is even before the iPhone was my last experience with that, it's actually a nice ecosystem. But so the problem with that is it's hard to change. It's hard to change quickly. It's hard to innovate because people are entrenched in that. I mean, you know, if anybody in IT knows when anything changes in their system, like in their interface, like people go crazy. I mean, anytime Google changes any slight thing of their interface, I get multiple calls about it. And so it's harder for Apple to quickly innovate. And I almost wonder if they'd be better off like having a second email app on the iPhone that you could download, like one that they could almost like a beta of something that they're working on. Because, you know, Microsoft is not entrenched on iOS. You know, they're trying to get new people so they can innovate. They're not having to appease, you know, millions of enterprise customers. And so Apple's kind of in this boat.
Yeah, I think there's always a burden that comes with being the default option on a platform. And I think for Apple, one of the big things that they've worked on in configuration over recent years is configuring email accounts to be secure. So they have things that manage open in, where the email client will only open documents in certain configured applications and so on for kind of data chain of custody and things like that. So there's a lot of additional requirements that are on the default app that aren't necessarily on these third-party apps. So I think that's also a kind of a burden on the platform owner as well that isn't on third-party apps.
The other strange thing about the calendar is, like, for example, so like I mentioned, I can't set a reoccurring appointment. So I went to Fantastical and created it and set it reoccurring, thinking that, you know, that the way that works is it kind of writes to the local calendar and these other apps can read it. I was mm-hmm. thinking that the Outlook app was reading that calendar, but it wasn't. Because when I went back to it, it wasn't there yet. It was only 10 seconds later when it kind of, I guess, pulled the iCloud that it mm-hmm. actually downloaded that change, which, you know, it's not a huge deal. It's just interesting that they're not actually reading the local database.
It is surprising for any iOS app that ships today to not be using the standard system API, because the way I noticed that was true was that when I set up my two Gmail accounts, my work one and my personal one, but I also use iCloud Calendar. And I also have a third account, which is like a shared calendar account at work that I manage. And neither of the iCloud nor this third account showed up in the mail program. So I've yet to go and see whether or not it's possible to you know, put in another CalDAV account and use that alongside. But I don't understand why they haven't done that, because that's just, you know, extra work for whatever reason. I'm not sure.
But again, I like this new Microsoft. I mean, it's just surprising that all the nerds are getting excited about an Outlook app. But it's a well-done app, and it really works, and especially if you're if you want those features like, you know, snoozing, this is a great way to do it.
Yeah, I think it's certainly big for people who are using Exchange, you know, because a lot of these other apps that have come out, you know, the mailbox and the other ones, they're mostly focusing on Gmail support, and then secondarily iCloud support, and then, you know, later on generic IMAP and so on. But there's not many that have got, you know, built in Exchange support.
Well, and this is not only is it helpful for that, but a lot of IT administrators are probably not keen on something like Mailbox with their mail platform. Mm-hmm. But if you're if you're running Microsoft Server, if you're running Exchange 365 or a local Exchange, and a user wants to download the Outlook app for iPhone, you're fine with that, even though if it is kind of polling your server in not a normal way, but it's Microsoft. So it's like letting Apple do something with your mobile device management system. You know, it's fine because you make it.
Yeah, they're a little more, they're not exactly first party, but they're first party to the server, if you like.
Right.
Yeah.
So, no, it's interesting. I think everybody should definitely give it a shot. And the new Microsoft is interesting. I think the big challenge for them, you know, we're not going to recap it, but they announced some, you know, new products last week. You know, Windows 10 is coming. They're in a situation where we're all acknowledging they're making good stuff, but it's getting people, when it comes time to buy a new device, to actually switch to it and not just say, oh, the new Microsoft is neat. That's not good enough. That doesn't pay the bills.
Well, this is it. You know, you and I might respect the Microsoft Surface 3, but there's no way either of us are even buying it, never mind adopting it. You know, so okay, it's cool, but cool's not enough, right? Particularly when you're as far behind in mobile as Microsoft are. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the problems that Microsoft has got is that anybody who was a Microsoft customer who was open to new experiences probably switched platforms about 5 years ago to Android, iOS, Mac, wherever they want to go. And I think the big problem they've got is that the vast majority of their customers are people who, as you said, Bradley, explicitly do not want change. And that's what they're paying Microsoft for, is not to change rather than to change. And I think the challenge with things like Windows 10 and particularly Windows Phone and Xbox, Kinect, HoloLens, all of this other stuff, even Skype, is to try and actually get back some traction and relevance for Microsoft. It's not that the company's in any kind of existential decline, because I don't think they are, but it seems to me that, you know, Microsoft can do stuff, but nobody thinks they're setting the agenda in any respect, particularly in the most important market sector that exists right now, which is mobile, and particularly mobile phones and secondarily tablets.
I never thought that would be this way, but I feel people's pain with all these frequent updates and all these questions, because it's not even just the interface, but it's the things like the printer drivers. Well, yeah, I think someone tweeted like a link to the new Peach Pit book on Yosemite that's coming out in February. And it's all like, that's the training manual for the certifications. Well, that's great. We're 4 months away from the beta of the next one.
Yeah.
And it is exhausting for the system administrators that have to keep up with drivers for these different, you know, peripherals, that you just get to a place. I mean, we're finally to a place with Yosemite where it's finally starting to be stable. You know, 10.10.2 does seem to fix a lot of bugs. I'm finally getting printer drivers out for all your big manufacturers, and you know you're just a few months away from hearing about the next thing. It's tiring.
Yeah, it is. And I think it's one of the things that I like about, you know, my life being increasingly inside Google Drive, is that as long as Chrome runs okay, I'm okay. And it's been difficult in recent months because Chrome actually hasn't run that well on OS X, particularly with respect to battery life. So it's a bit of swings and roundabouts, you know, but it's I kind of feel like more and more my life is just kind of floating up to the cloud rather than being on any particular device. And that's where a lot of my interest and my thinking lies right now.
Before we move on, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Squarespace. Now, Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, and online store. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, visit squarespace.com/out of school and sign up for a free trial. And then once you use the free trial and love the service, when you check out, use the offer code PUPIL and you'll get 10% off. And if you pay by the year, you'll even get a free domain name included. It works out to about $8 a month for the starter package. Every plan has built-in e-commerce. There's nothing to set up. The software is just built in. You're not buying a server elsewhere than installing Squarespace on it. They have 24/7 support. They have a great blogging app for the iPhone. You can get supports Markdown. So if you're into that, it works great with that. And they have a new version 7 back in that's, again, nothing for you to do. It's just a lot more refinements. So if you're looking to start a website for your school, for your sports team, for your club, check out Squarespace and use the offer code PUPIL for 10% off. Thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring the show this week.
Okay, so let me tell you about my week and the things that I have seen. Basically, there was these two different events that I can talk about and one I can't talk about, but I think actually on balance wasn't the most important of the things that I saw. The first day I was down in London, went down on Monday night of last week, sleeper train down from Glasgow to London, and then I spent the day at the Apple Leadership Summit. And that's the Apple Leadership Summit is an interesting event because it's not a public event. It's by invitation. but there are a large number of people invited. And the thing that's confusing to everybody is that there's actually the same event happens 4 days in a row. So every year before, it's kind of like, hey, are you going to be in London for the leadership event? Yeah. Are you? Yeah. And then you go and the person's not there because you're both talking about a different day, because they never say, they only invite you to one specific day. They don't say, would you like your pick of 4 different days? So you're invited on Tuesday and you're invited on Wednesday. And as a result, you don't always see the people you expect to see at that event. But it was held at a place called King's Place, which is just round the back from King's Cross Station in London. And they had a mixture of plenary events where, you know, everybody was in the one big room and they were, we were getting given a message, if you like. And then there was a few breakout sessions that we went to. So the first thing always in the day is the Apple Vision, right? You've seen this kind of thing, Bradley, I'm sure. But it's kind of like the Apple Vision for learning. And mostly it's about... is built around a few different things. The devices, the iPad mostly, and they sort of talk about the Mac as well. And then the software that's available, iLife, iWork, iBooks, a podcasts app. And this year, for the first time, they sort of explicitly included the cloud as a component of the ecosystem. You know, they talked about iCloud as part of that. And then, obviously, you've got the content aspect of it, which is iTunes U, App Store, iTunes Store, and the iBook Store. And then finally, they talk about the teaching and learning aspect of it as well. And I don't know if you've ever seen this at Apple events, Bradley, but it's quite, they walk quite a fine line there where they want to talk about your classroom practice and what you do in the classroom, but they also want to hold back from saying, well, you should teach this way. Because that kind of, unless of course it's Google who are saying this, and then we just revolutionized the entire education system because of what Eric Schmidt says. If it was Apple, I think people are quite aware that there would be quite a fuss if it was, you know, Apple, how dare Apple tell us how to teach, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas if Eric Schmidt gets up and says, more people should code, everybody just jumps to however high he wants people to jump. So that was kind of the subtext of the whole thing. And then they had a speaker from a school called the Stephen Peirce Foundation, which is in Cambridge. And I really enjoyed her presentation. I thought it was an excellent presentation because what she did was she related the changes that she's making to her school to the changes that are happening outside of school in the real world. And I think, you know, Bradley, as you know, and as listeners will know, that's a big theme of mine, big concern of mine has been for a long time now, is how do we make school more like the real world? So that was something that I really appreciated. And it was quite unusual to see that at an EdTech conference. Usually you just get given the usual bromides about our children will do jobs that haven't been invented yet. And everybody sort of nods along to that. But really trying to connect globalization and the merging of cultures across the world and making that something that we can and should bring into school with technology, along with teaching, along with other exchange programs and different things. I thought that was a really powerful message to give, and I was really glad that Apple chose her to do that.
No, that's, it sounds like a nice change, because that same mantra we've just been hearing for, gosh, a decade at this point about our, you know, children will do things differently. And I mean, I think we've always often said that we the future is so far away in some ways that, I mean, when I was 5 years old, my parents, it was hard to envision what would be, you know, when you don't know what's coming, mm-hmm. How do you teach to that?
Yeah. Yeah. And I always think, you know, when people say that thing about jobs that haven't been invented yet, I think, you know, I always imagine like an internet grocery order delivery driver. You know, that's the kind of job that don't have, you know, that job never existed, but I don't think any futurist sitting back in 1980 was envisaging a great day of their own children driving a truck around with groceries in the back, or driving for Uber or whatever, or being a task rabbit. You know, not all futuristic jobs are great jobs. I mean, that's something that we have to bear in mind as well. So that's something to be careful with too. But what I thought was interesting throughout the whole leadership summit was that there was a greater focus on deploying correctly. And this was something I had noticed a change in from previous years. Where previously they would just sort of say, well, Apple Configurator is one of our software components and you use that to set up your iPads. Actually, this year there were a number of explicit slides that showed, and to be honest with you, Bradley, the slides looked very much like our deployment series from last year. It was a slide of about 14 points, and it had things like leadership, vision, planning, infrastructure, financing, rollout, ownership, content delivery, all these things. And I thought it was really good to see Apple explicitly calling out the manageability and the sustainability of a deployment program as something that really needs to be front and center in the conversation about should you adopt or scale your use of these devices. Because I think too often in the past, they've sort of said, well, they've waved their hands at that a little bit, and people have gone ahead and done deployments, making it up as they went along sort of thing. And I think one of the things, nobody said this to me, but I get the sense that one of the concerns is that there are a number of iPad deployments around the UK and indeed around the world that are on the brink of collapse because they haven't scaled properly and they're built on the wrong foundations, like one Apple ID for the whole school or no device management server or piecemeal purchasing of devices in an unsustainable fashion. And the things we talked about in our deployment series, and I think I certainly got a sense of concern about that being the case in many countries around the world.
It's like they listen to our show.
I can't imagine any of the Apple listeners to our show.
Well, I think from Apple's perspective, obviously they care about their deployments, but from a revenue perspective, they repeat customers are an easy source of revenue. Mm-hmm. So if you have these 3 to 4 year leases, well, you can pretty much say, well, year four, we're going to have this, you know, this school, this district is going to buy X number of another iPads or another Macs. And so it's about making sure your customers are happy post-purchase so they stay your customers.
Yeah, and as a result of that, there was much more explicit talk about Wi-Fi infrastructure because I think this is one of the most common areas in which deployments are running into difficulty. Is not even because they've not deployed the devices well or got an Apple ID strategy in place, but it's because their infrastructure is not up to the steady state use of what people want to do with the device. And I really... That was a marked change from previous years. In any previous event I've been to where they explicitly said, look, forget it with your home Wi-Fi kit. You got to go and get something that will handle large numbers of clients. And they explicitly called out in an event for teachers the difference between signal coverage and density in Wi-Fi, which is a level of thinking that I hadn't seen before from an Apple platform. And it was really, really welcome to see that too.
Well, that's just become... You know, as these devices continue to get smaller, things like properly tuned Wi-Fi, it matters even more. I mean, when I'm looking, I saw the maps today for our 11AC coverage, and to get true 11AC speeds, we're going to actually have to have more APs because mm-hmm. I can't rely on 2.4 gigahertz for those speeds.
Yeah,
so
you've got to
think through that more, and you may have to spend a little bit more on your infrastructure. As you add devices, as you get different devices. I mean, you in some ways have a different deployment strategy for the Mac Wi-Fi wise than you do the iPad mini.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. Particularly when you have devices that have such markedly different capabilities in terms of the number of antenna and so on, the number of channels and streams they can support.
Yeah, it always amazes me the difference in like signal strength that the iPhone gets and the Mac gets in the same spot. Mm-hmm. It really is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, we've got some areas in our school where if you walk from one room to another in a certain way, and a phone will not roam correctly onto the next AP. But if you were to walk with a Mac, it would be fine. So it's things like that that are just, you know, these are the fine points of tweaking that we're starting to get to with these things. So I suppose just to wrap up the Apple Leadership Summit, you were asking me about the iBeacon example. So there was one, there were iBeacons all around the place, and I had an early fail personally, which was when you go to the event, they give everybody an iPad to use for the day, and it's configured with certain apps and so on. And they have a conference app. So when you pre-register for the conference, they give you this app, this iPad with the app, and you type in your name, and it's supposed to give you your schedule for the day. And just as I was typing my name in, the app crashed and hadn't saved any of my information. So I relaunched the app, and the first screen says, please scan a QR code for your event And I said, well, you know, where's the QR code for me to scan? And they said, oh, well, we're just using iBeacon for that. And for the whole day, could I get this stupid app to actually get back on an iBeacon in order to get my schedule? So I was basically wandering the hallways, no idea where I was going, just following the herd every time, which was a surprisingly effective strategy, I'll say. But the app basically never recovered from crashing within the first 2 minutes of me being there. So I carried this iPad around all day and then didn't do anything with it. But they were giving the iPads out in without cases. And one of the things I really noticed was that every session was just punctuated by the sound of people dropping these iPads all over the place. And it's like, is it possible there might be a slight industrial design problem with the iPad here? Because, you know, case-free, these things are just like, you know, they're like wet ice. Try to hold them. So, but what happened was that the iBeacons were used in different ways. And one of the ways they were used was we went to a deployment session. And in the deployment session, the person who was giving a demo, they were using Casper Suite actually, the person who was giving a demo said, I'm just going to take control of your iPads. And by your, he just meant the ones in the room. Now, he had not pre-configured any group in Casper to be that group of people because, you know, I wasn't actually supposed to be in that session and they managed to take over my iPad as well. And what they did was, as you walked into the room, the device saw an iBeacon and reported that. And then the group was any device which has recently seen this beacon ID. And then they were all put into one group. And what they did was they just pushed a gated access profile, or they used Casper Focus to focus all the iPads in the room on Safari. And that was without any pre-configuration. So I thought that was a pretty cool trick. They had Estimote beacons all over the place, and I thought there were, you know, definitely some applications of that in the classroom as well.
That's a market that I am thinking like I'll really be interested in over the next, say, 24 to 36 months, that we're setting up the technology, the foundation, but now let's see what applications come from it and see how that, you know, is this an administration thing, or is this something that actually can affect the classroom management? It'd be interesting to watch.
Yeah, I think there's definitely opportunities there. I heard all over the week people sort of trying to give educational uses for iBeacon, and I really felt that they were very much just like the kind of things we've done with QR codes, except now you can't see where the QR code is anymore. And it's things like sticking them on things and sending the kids on a treasure hunt to find things. And I didn't find any educational uses particularly compelling, but I think the sysadmin uses may be more interesting over time.
Before we move on, let's thank our next sponsor of the night, the fine folks at Jamp Software. As we mentioned, Jamp provides IT staff with tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies in your schools. This includes Macs, iPhones, iPads, and Apple TVs. They have a great app for teachers called Casper Focus that lives on their iPad that gives them control of their deployment in their classroom. So they can initiate AirPlay, they can distribute iBooks, they can quickly gain students' attention, they can even conduct secure exams within right in the app. So if you want to learn more about Casper Focus and about Jamp Software and the Casper Suite, go to outofschool.net. This is show 119, and I have a special link for you to click on. So again, thanks to Jamp for sponsoring the show.
Great. So that was Monday, Tuesday. And then Wednesday, we spent Wednesday in the Executive Briefing Center at Apple, which is a rather nice facility they have in their offices in London. Just mostly conference rooms, and we had a few presentations there at which they begged us not to take photographs and not to tweet about it at the time. They didn't actually explicitly mention podcasting, but I think we'll just pass on from what happened there, because it was actually, in fact, another deployment session where they talked in some detail about deployment. And I got into an argument with somebody about, not somebody at Apple, but somebody else in the audience about whether or not one should supervise iOS devices. And this is actually probably as useful as anything that was said from the front. The argument from the other side was that it's a responsibility issue. And if you supervise, you're taking away responsibility from the student and taking that responsibility to yourself. And therefore, the student isn't learning the methods of being responsible with a computer. And I think, and my argument in return, and it's the argument we've made previously for doing supervision, is that the difficulty with not supervising is actually if you ever find yourself in a situation where you have to supervise a device, the consequences of that are so difficult that you'll wish you'd supervised in the first place, because basically you've got to wipe the device completely and set it up from scratch after you supervise. So if you ever need any of the controls that supervision gives you, you're going to wish you had supervised. And I think that the other person who was talking, I think they maybe were conflating the idea of supervising the device with imposing the restrictions that supervision enables. And I was trying to make the point that it's not necessarily that you have to apply those restrictions just because you've supervised, but what you're doing with supervision is you're basically keeping your options open for the future. Should you ever need to disable FaceTime, disable iMessage, whatever, that only supervision can give you. So that was something that I hadn't really contemplated that. I just assumed that everybody was supervising, but I guess some people are not doing that. That was what I learned there.
Well, it's giving the students the key, but you also have the master key.
Yeah. I'm not sure if I'm 100% correct in this, but I think, you know how NDM servers can bypass the activation lock?
Yes.
I'm not sure if that's only for supervised devices. Do you know that?
I would say it is, but I don't know for sure. But if I have to guess, knowing what I know about the way the system is implemented, that seems like something that would require a supervised device. Now that I say that, I don't think it is.
I'm really not sure. But anyway, that was actually another question that came up actually at the summit. Was in the deployment session, the guy puts his hand up and says, we've got devices that are activation locked. How do we get around that? And the answer is basically, design a time machine, go back to the beginning of your deployment, supervise all your devices, put them in NDM, and then you can generate an activation lock bypass code. So there's not a great answer for that after the problem has occurred, but something to be aware of as well. So that was the Apple stuff. And then the next part of the week, the Thursday, Friday, I was at BET, as I kind of had been trailing on the show for a few weeks. And I was really grateful. Firstly, let me say a thank you to everybody who came to both sessions that I spoke at. It was really, particularly the first session, the BYOD session, and then the school leaders session as well, were both very well attended. And I really appreciate everybody who came to that and, you know, stayed around to ask questions or whatever afterwards, which was great. Let me tell you a little bit about what I saw on the show floor. You know, for people who are not familiar with BET, BET is a little bit like ISTE in the United States or the Scottish Learning Festival in Scotland. It's essentially an ed tech trade show, and deals are done there, and, you know, contracts are signed and all that kind of stuff, and wares are shown to the people going by. And the show floor was big. You know, the Scottish Learning Festival has shrunk dramatically over the years, but the BET show is still very big. But what was most interesting, Bradley, about the show floor, I thought, was how uninteresting most of it was. That, you know, not having been to an event like that for quite a long time, I was seeing very similar things to what I had seen, you know, 5, 7, 8 years ago. And that was telling, I thought, that the state of the union on educational technology is basically the stuff that we know. And there's not significant breakthroughs coming from anybody at the moment. So the way I sort of rule of thumbed it was about 30 to 40% of the show floor was still all about classroom displays, right? Whiteboards, projectors, touchscreen interactive televisions, but still all very much, you know, front of room display technology. That was a big, big part of it, surprisingly big part of it. And also the stands where those manufacturers were displaying Promethean, Smart, you know, kind of hard to believe Smart are still in business, but they are. Those were huge stands. You know, I was really surprised that they were as big a feature as they were.
You know, it seems that the innovation is in a limited number of hardware manufacturers. So you go to these conferences and you see some things that, like, they look cool, but you're like, you know, I'm never buying this for my school. We do not, you know, if we have a limited number of resources, I'm never going to be able to, like, buy this big display for every classroom. We're never going to have the resources to do that unless we get a big grant. And so the innovation, yeah, exactly. You know, the innovation is coming from a few hardware people, but it's all about the software that interacts with that hardware. So, yeah, I felt that way when I went to ISTE I guess it was summer before last, and it's like stuff that's neat, but you're like, you know, if they came in and pitched you, you know, the quote's going to be like tens of thousands of dollars to deck your school out and this stuff. And it, to me, that kind of stuff doesn't change our school. It doesn't make learning that much better. It's just a toy in some ways that, like, it's something else to fiddle with. It's something that looks good on a school tour, mm-hmm. but it doesn't really change us from, okay, this is how this has impacted us day to day.
Yeah, and sometimes those things are very much, you know, it's the kind of thing that all schools have got, so you've got to have it as well. And I've said before, you know, that was one of our main rationales for buying interactive whiteboards in the early years was every other school had them. So when people came to our school, they would ask us, where are your interactive whiteboards? And in some cases, you know, that was the check mark of IT integration in the classroom, was that you used the interactive whiteboard. And if you didn't, you were suspect in some way and you had to be investigated more deeply, shall we say. So that was one of the big things that I saw. Surprised to still see it. There was also a big, big push on device management software. And, of course, the big players were there. I saw the folks from Casper were there. Jam Software were there. Who else was there?
AirWatch.
AirWatch people were working. Lightspeed. I saw various things. But I also saw a tier below that, if you like, of newer upstart MDM providers, if you like. And I was, again, that was the kind of thing I was just like, there is no way I am buying that for my school, because at that level, that's such a strategic part of your system that you can't, you've got to trust a reasonably big company to do that for you, to at least be around by the time you come to refresh your devices. So mom and pop MDM is now a thing, apparently. So that was interesting. And also in large part, it seems to be getting tacked onto web filtering. So the companies that were doing the web filtering before, your Smoothwall and different things, you know, I'm starting to see them sort of being either bundled with or integrated with MDM provision in some sense. So there's a big software push in device management in schools as well.
Well, that's been a big merger and acquisition market for a few years now. And I think VMware owns AirWatch, IBM owns Maz 360. These companies, you know, I'm really surprised that a McAfee or a Norton hasn't bought someone, because these companies have no future in a kind of in a post-PC world. You know, why does someone need, think about a home user, there's no need for VMware Fusion, and obviously the server stuff is still huge, but they want a way to be able to sell something else to organizations. So, you know, someone, you know, IBM, same reason. They want to be able to sell device management. Of course, I guess it's interesting that they own that, then they're working with Apple as well. That's an interesting combination I haven't thought of. But yeah, that's been an easy thing to buy. It's a hot market, because, you know, on the desktop you can sell an add-on like, you know, McAfee Enterprise Virus Scanning or malware protection on the server. There is none of that for iOS. There is none of that for Chromebooks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what you're seeing is MDM as a kind of table stakes deployment, and then it's like, what can you do on top of MDM? You know, so the MDM protocol, like we said before, is so simple that almost everybody can support the whole suite of functionality. The question is, what can you provide on top, or what else can you integrate with in order to be more valuable to the business? And that either looks like we integrate with our filtering and reporting system, or we integrate with your Active Directory, or we integrate with your Google Apps, or whatever it is. To try and build some value on top of just being able to push and pull MDM commands to and from devices. I also saw a big push on enterprise Wi-Fi. So I saw not so much the vendors themselves, although Aerohive were there, but what we saw was kind of value-added resellers having a big push on, this is our Wi-Fi. And it might be, you know, we do Maru, and we can also do your MDM and your filtering, or we do Ruckus and your filtering, or Aruba or whatever. So it's kind of like strong Wi-Fi bundled with other products as a value add. So that was something that is, you know, clearly coming as a thing to talk about. You know, not just at the talking to the IT manager level, but, you know, something for individual teachers to take back. And I think that speaks to the idea that weak or poor Wi-Fi is starting to really impact the average teacher's job experience now, which I would argue it probably didn't in previous years. So they're now speaking to school leaders, head teachers, senior teachers about, you know, we've got a Wi-Fi solution for you. Because let me tell you, many of these teachers know that they have a Wi-Fi problem and they're now being marketed to at that level. Whether they're ready to hear those messages and whether they're ready to make decisions based on that is probably not clear yet. But at least it's interesting that that conversation about infrastructure is coming down to the teacher and head teacher level rather than up at the authority level or the district level. So that's something that's really changed over the past few years, I think.
It's all about that push into managed service providers where, you know, you don't care, you don't want to piece together the Wi-Fi vendor, MDM vendor, security vendor. You just know you need a solution. So you go to a VAR and you can say, look, we're wanting to do this kind of deployment. We need some help. And so they design the solution, they manage it, they tweak it, and you're paying them for that service. So you don't care that you have Maru or Aerohive or Ruckus or Jamf or AirWatch or whoever. You just care that you have the solution. And you have one that can support it. And there's a market for that. And if you're a smaller school without a dedicated IT staff or, even a full-time IT staff, like there's a market for being able to just write a check and say, you provide us with this solution and you deal with it. Mm-hmm. You tell us when it's time for 11AC and things like that.
Yeah, they'll tell you that it's not for years and years and years because it's not in the contract. Managed service providers are a whole conversation in themselves, I think, but I've seen too many schools caught in managed service provision contracts that are catastrophically outdated technologically from what they currently need. And I think that this transition to mobile devices actually caught a lot of people out because they had signed 5 and 8 year contracts with big, big companies to provide them with an Ethernet network and Max running Snow Leopard, right? And then the world changes and you want 10 times the number of devices on your network. You want Wi-Fi everywhere and you want everything. You want iOS, you want MDM, you want volume purchase. And it's difficult to renegotiate those contracts in the middle. So it's something to be aware of that, you know, if you are going to go down that line, don't sign too long a contract lest you get caught in the next technological transition. What else happened? What else did I see? Lenovo had a huge presence, and I was interested and surprised that it was almost entirely Windows devices that they were pushing, and they weren't making a big deal of their Chromebook offerings, which are quite good and interesting Chromebooks, but their big stand was mostly Windows devices. Google had a huge stand. Well, actually, it wasn't huge. It could have been bigger because it was crushed the whole time I was there. I could hardly get close to anything that was there. But they're showing the full range of Chromebooks that exist. They also had the LG Chromebase, which is a kind of 21-inch display Chrome desktop computer that's kind of like an iMac in terms of its physical configuration. And they had, I think it was the Dell Chromebox or the Acer Chromebox, one of the two on their stand as well, along with a range of Nexus tablets and so on. And on the other side of their stand, they had a little theater where they had people presenting different things. And big push in Classroom, of course, obviously. And they also announced the Google Play Store for Education in the UK at the event. So they were showing off some of the features of that. So that was interesting. And the big thing in Chromebooks that happened this week was that Acer launched their 15-inch Chromebooks, the C9 something something. There's a couple of different models. The one I saw was the base model, which has a slightly low resolution, I thought, display. It's 15 inches, yes, but it wasn't really high res. They did actually have, or they will have, a 1080p version of that laptop, which is a bit more expensive, but not too much more expensive. And according to the people I was talking to, that was really the one to get. Because it wasn't that much more money and it was significantly better screen. I think it's also perhaps an IPS display at that level. So that was interesting. It was very much, if you imagine a MacBook Pro, Bradley, but done in black plastic, it was kind of like that. It reminded me very much of the black MacBooks of yore, and it's got the kind of slight dish that the MacBooks have for the keyboard, and it had chiclet keys and quite a nice kind of carbon fiberish exterior. And, you know, big 15-inch display. So those are interesting, I think. And I think we'll start to see more options in the Chromebook space over the next few years. I think it's going to be, it's definitely a growing market for those vendors.
Well, they Yeah, they also announced some of their new education-specific models that can handle higher drops. And I think that was pretty interesting as well. That's the C910 and the C740. But that'll be interesting. They can be dropped from 45 centimeters without damage, and the hinges have been reinforced as well. Of course, haven't had to deal with broken hinges in a long time. That's an old PC game.
Yeah, that takes me back to your titanium MacBooks. Or PowerBooks, as they were.
Yes,
titanium hinges that snapped off after a couple of years. The thing that blew my mind, though, on the show floor, Bradley, was the prevalence of 3D printers. These things are really kind of coming of age, I think. And they've been on the way for a long time. But I spent some good time looking at the Ultimaker printer, and also the MakerBot, which are one of the big companies in the space. And I was blown away by some of the things these people had printed out. Big, big models. There was a set of animal skulls that they'd printed out. Even models of engines with multiple parts in them. Different things like that. And, you know, I think you can watch all the videos you want about a 3D printer, but watching something just appear out of nothing in front of your eyes is really something to watch, I think. And some of the things they were telling me about what's coming with 3D printing are fascinating, you know. So there's new filament coming out that is infused with wood, metal, and stone. And these materials really feel like the materials that are infused. So it's still plastic, but, you know, the wood filament smells a bit woody, and the metal one has a weight to it, and the stone one has a real heft to it. And you can, you know, you can sand them, you can drill them in different things, and the way you could work those materials. So I think it's a very interesting time. The cheapest MakerBot printer is down to £1,000. In the UK, and filament rolls are down to about £14 for the ones that fit into that model. So I feel, from what I saw, I really felt that the creation part of 3D printing is quite good. Like, if you've got a digital model, you can print it without too much difficulty now. But what I'm hoping to see in the next couple of steps is for the modeling part to get easier. It seems to me that it's still not very difficult, but moderately difficult to create your own model from scratch. And I'd like to see the tools get a little simpler and a little more intuitive. And also I'd like to see those tools come more over to mobile devices as well, so that we could use them in conjunction with device cameras and so on. I think that would be really powerful.
I read an article this week about how Amazon Prime shipping has been great for, like, people in very rural areas. The article was about Alaska. We're talking about how I mean, that's huge for them because they can actually get stuff in a decent amount of time. Of course, I'm sure Amazon's losing their shirt. But then it got me thinking about, we had been iMessaging about 3D printers, and I got me thinking about how something like that will be so huge for rural areas. Of course, they have to have the internet connection to be able to download the plans, but getting the printers down in price is another big thing. But yeah, that could be huge. I mean, you don't have to worry about living 30 minutes from the nearest hardware store. You can, if you need a, you know, need something, you can make it.
Exactly, yeah. And I think they also had this thing on the MakerBot stand that was like a turntable with stereo cameras on it. So you could put an object on this turntable and spin it around and scan it into a basic 3D model. And that was where I thought, you know, hang on a minute, that is, you know, that's basically a photocopier for things. You know, it's kind of crazy. So I'm very interested in that in the next couple of years. What I'm trying to do right now is collect use cases for a 3D printer in the school, and see if I can think up enough common reasons that we might want it on a daily basis that would justify us getting one in the future. And we've come up with some, but I can't challenge the kids. If they can think up 500 reasons to get one, we'll buy it. They're working on that.
Hopefully by that time, they'll be cheaper as well.
Mm, yeah, definitely. So let me just wrap up on the events that I spoke at. We had two events. One was supposed to be a bring your own device debate, which in fact ended up being a little bit more of a kind of why one-to-one is a good thing discussion. And that's fine. I mean, I'm very much on board with that as a concept, that one-to-one is a good idea in schools. But it didn't turn out into the debate that I think needs to be had, which is, what are the benefits and drawbacks? You know, an honest discussion of the benefits and drawbacks of bringing your own device versus doing some kind of school-managed deployment. And I'm on record on the podcast and on Twitter and on my blog as saying that I think a school-provided deployment is actually the right way to go. But, you know, plenty of schools are going for bring your own device as well. But we didn't really end up having that conversation. But what I thought afterwards that was interesting was that it's very noticeable to me now, compared to the experience of 5 years ago, that very few people now are seriously arguing that one-to-one in schools should not happen from educational or moral grounds. It's the kind of thing where we're now debating the price and we're debating which device it should be, but nobody is seriously saying, I don't think every pupil in school should have a computer. And there were people who were saying that 4 and 5 years ago when we started our iPad deployment. They were saying, I don't think this is a good idea. I think educationally this is invalid, blah, 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 blah. And I think that discussion has basically, that argument has been won, I think. And what we're debating now is how we're going to do it and when we're going to do it, rather than whether we should do it at all. Now, there are certain people who are sort of have a very romantic view of childhood and education that for some reason they think shouldn't include digital devices. They're quite happy for their children to depend on many other forms of technology such as medicine, heating, lighting, vision correction glasses, but just not computers. And it's a wee bit like the people who love paper books. It's very difficult to have an actual discussion on that because it's mostly based on emotional reaction to something rather than a logical argument one way or the other. But apart from that kind of scene, I really feel like, you know, most people now in education are wondering when it's going to happen. And I know that in almost every school I've been to, a majority of parents are just wondering why this is taking so long.
Yeah, it's a different sort of question. It's no longer yes or no, but it's like the, you know, step one is yes, but then the discussion is around step 2, 3, 4, and 5.
Yeah. And it's good to be over that hurdle, I think. And we'll see where it goes next. I think I feel like more is up for grabs than has ever been. And particularly with the whole, you know, full court press on Chromebooks and Google Classroom. I think schools looking to do a one-to-one program, you know, I feel like, you know, Chromebook is pushing at an open door for many schools. And I think, you know, I've said before and I'll say again that if it was Chromebooks in a one-to-one situation or shared iPads, I would totally go for the Chromebooks because I really believe one-to-one is the most important aspect in which device you buy is actually a distant second to being one-to-one. And that's a big cultural change that I think is broader than just let's all get iPads or whatever. It's let's be a one-to-one school, and whatever device enables you to get to that level of provision, I think that's an important thing to think about.
Then get the TI-83 calculators.
One-to-one Kindles.
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor of the night. You guys know them. It's the fine folks from Shobee. It's an iPad app for paperless classrooms. With this app, teachers can quickly and easily assign, collect, and review student work on their iPads, and then provide rich feedback to students by adding annotations, text notes, and voice notes directly onto their documents. Students can show their learning creatively by submitting to Shobee from thousands of compatible iPad apps or by completing assignments with Shobee's built-in tools. Shobee keeps everyone organized with individual student assignment folders, email, and push notifications. Shobee Basic is free, and teachers can get started on it with their classroom today in just a few minutes. And you can go to the App Store and search for Shobee or go to Shobee.com. And if you want to look at the pro version, they have a special deal for listeners of our show. You can get five free for the entire year. So they go to Shobee.com/out of school. It's Shobee.com/out of school. And again, you buy Shobee Pro for 5 teachers and you'll get an additional 5 teachers for free for a year. Thanks to Shobee for sponsoring the show this week.
Yeah, so the last presentation I did was at what they call the School Leaders Summit, which was a kind of track just for middle and senior managers in schools. And it was one of those situations where I actually was kind of late getting there. I don't like to get to places at last minute when I'm presenting, but I was in a taxi and trying to get there. Traffic was heavy, and I was supposed to speak at 10 past 3, and I got there at 5 to 3. And this place is a huge place. It's the size of like 2 football fields. I'm trying to find this tiny little corner where I'm supposed to be presenting. So I'm running about a bit crazy. But I got there in time. And just as I was about to kind of get ready and start, the person who was comparing it said, yeah, so she said, you've got 30 minutes, right? So that's 20 minutes for your presentation and 10 minutes for questions. And I was like, nobody told me it was going to be 10 minutes of questions, right? So I had actually prepared a whole 30-minute presentation. So I had to kind of accelerate it a little bit. But I did get to the end, thankfully, and showed everything I wanted to show and got some really good questions as well at the end. So it was basically a 30-minute version of my usual presentation about, you know, basically just the first 4.5 years of our iPad deployment at Cedars and the rationale behind it and some of the things that we think about. You know, stuff that we've talked about on the show many, many times. And I think it was a good opportunity to speak to people who had come looking for knowledge and inspiration. And I really appreciated the opportunity to speak there. And I was really grateful to everybody who came. So it was a good session too.
Well, sometimes we need just like those motivational sessions that aren't like necessarily practical, but they're just going to sit and listen to stories and they spur ideas for your own school.
Yeah. And I think this is where there's, you know, what is the state of the EdTech Union right now? I think we have a lot of strong technologies in our hands. Yes, they could all be better. Of course, they could all be better. That's always true. But we have, you know, isn't it great that we've got Chromebook and iPad and all the work that's going in from those two companies to provide infrastructure, systems, services, apps, deployment technologies for schools? We're in a great situation with technology, I think. And what we're looking for is we're looking for leadership and we're looking for execution. And I feel that those are the two things that have to come to the fore now. That we've now been presented with a whole set of technology that is rich, powerful, and most importantly, very affordable, never been more affordable. But the question is, who's going to step up and lead people into this world? And I'm looking for people all over the country, all over the world, to come to the fore and say, I'm going to lead this, I'm going to take this forward. And I think the thing is that I've realized, Bradley, though, is that it's got to be senior people in the school. It can't just be an enthusiast teacher, because most schools, that person doesn't have enough power or influence to actually get something done. I'm looking for school leaders, school managers, people in local government at all levels, and even national and international politicians and respected people in that field to really step forward and say, okay, this idea is an idea whose time has come. We have to make resources available, but more importantly, we have to lead into that new world, and we have to accept all the changes that it implies. Because too often right now, we're in a situation where we can make a number of changes, but we refuse to take it to its logical conclusion. And I think really the big ask right now from the education world is leadership, serious leadership into that new world. And that's what I hope to inspire some people to be, those leaders. I hope to inspire them with, you know, our story, and hopefully they can implement something similar as it applies appropriately to their places as well.
Well, I was talking to a teacher today about I gave her that Douglas Adams quote that you mentioned a few weeks ago about things that, you know, 0 to 18, it's technology is part of the natural way. Things that were done between 18 and 35 is new and exciting to you, and over 35 feels against the natural order. And she, you know, we were talking about that, and she totally agreed with it. And I said, you know, you think about what we've done in the last 4 years of technology, how things have changed. And so you just think about, like, what do the next 8 years bring? Because technology seems to be accelerating the way it changes and you know, it's becoming so ingrained in our lives. You mentioned Eric Schmidt from Google talking about how he thinks the internet goes away, not because the internet disappears, but it's like electricity. You assume everything you have connects to the internet. You know, like we were buying a new slow cooker recently, and we got the one without Wi-Fi because the one with Wi-Fi was so expensive. But there will be a time when they will all have Wi-Fi.
I was showing my wife a kitchen scale that had Wi-Fi and had an app that went along with it as well. Of course, my concern with all of that is fragility, right? How long is that app going to keep working? But I think you're right, and Eric Schmidt is right as well, even though the way that was reported was kind of bizarre. And it's not just that we will all evolve into an enlightened plane of existence with technology as much as demographics will just take care of all. You know, we're looking at a situation now where were we to introduce Chromebook to our school, isn't this ironic? The major barrier to Chromebook adoption would be the Chromebook keyboard. Let me say that again. The barrier to adopting Chromebooks would be the fact that it has a hardware keyboard, and people would reject that. Students would reject it. Students have already said to me, I don't want you to do that because I don't like that stupid plastic keyboard. And isn't it interesting how in just 5 years, the majority of our school now thinks that way, whereas 5 years ago, 7 years ago, people were saying you've got to have that kind of technology, otherwise people literally can't use it. And now we're in a situation where people are saying, if you give me that plastic keyboard, I literally don't know what to do with it anymore. And it's interesting to just see how the tables have turned in that time.
Yeah, and the thing, you know, I always joke when I say that whenever my son sees a commercial on TV, he thinks the TV's broken. He says, something's wrong with the TV, Daddy, my show's not on. And it's just a new...
Why can't I watch the 4th hour of Peppa Pig?
Right. Well, and we see life and we see everything that happened before it mm-hmm. in our lives. The kids today, they don't have those memories. And so their perspectives on things are that is drastically different. I see things like the Apple Watch right now and I think, I am good. Like I am not, I always have email. Like, you know, it's like I see that it's neat, but I'm not that excited about it. And I just don't see where it adds to my life. Where someone that's 10 today is seeing that and thinking of it as something new that is exciting.
Well, there's nothing April wants more in her entire life than an Apple Watch. Like she's that, you know, this is new and exciting and I could get a career in wearables kind of thing. Whereas I'm looking at it going, well, I get it, but, you know, I could take or leave the first version. But, you know, you're absolutely right. She's looking at it that way. And, you know, the focus of things like email is it's really important for us to try and keep abreast of the way in which young people coming up think. And it's really important to me personally to always be talking to the kids, not just about the curriculum and about the things that we teach, but taking their temperature about, you know, what services do you use? Where do you spend your time? And where they spend their time, we've said it before, Bradley, is YouTube and Instagram. Ain't nobody on Facebook, because that's where your mom and dad are.
Yeah, it's we had a conversation about that on YouTube internally, that talking about how kids today view YouTube is how we viewed the internet. You know, 75% of the internet's terrible, but the 25% that's there is the reason we have it in schools, and YouTube's the same way. 75% of it's junk, but there's 25% of it that's incredible.
Yep, yep. And they very much view YouTube the same way. My channels are awesome. The rest, okay, is there, but I'm not saying it's so bad that I have to get off the whole of YouTube. You know, it's the same, you know, the same way we looked at the internet before. Yeah, okay, there's bad stuff on the internet, but there's so much good stuff that it justifies its existence on that basis. So that's kind of where I think we are with EdTech right now, particularly in the large, as you would see at an event like BET. It's I think we're in a good place. You know, I kind of came away both inspired and struggling a little bit with some things. You know, we've got all this great technology. I'm asking the question, where's that leadership that's going to take the majority of young people into this world? Is great for people who come to my school, right? It's great for people who come to your school. But I'm detecting now frustration on the part of parents of children at schools who are not one-to-one or not technology forward. They're asking the question, why is my child not getting these opportunities as well? And nothing could hearten me more than for that to be the case. I gave a presentation 3 years ago in Hull, and one of the slides I put up was, if there is hope, it lies with the parents. And the reason I said that was because it's the parents who drive major change, because the parents have voting power, they have parental pressure power in the schools, and they have opinions that they can use to influence other people and influence other parents in the school community as well. And I certainly hope that that dissatisfaction will grow to a point where this becomes an inevitable thing. It simply has to happen. And of course, as people of our generation move into more management areas in school and beyond schools, I certainly hope that we'll take those attitudes with us as well and try and implement these programs on a wider scale.
Sounds like a great place to end it for this week.
Yeah. So it was a good week. And I met many good people, many podcast listeners as well. That's always an absolute delight, is when people come up and say, man, I love your podcast, or even that they mildly enjoy it, which is welcome too. I met people from, you know, where did I meet people from? Finland. I met people from all over the UK, people from other parts of Europe as well, who were podcast listeners, and it was great. Thank you all for coming up and saying hi. I really appreciate it. I know, Bradley, you get that kind of thing in your events as well, and it's always a thrill.
Yeah, it's, you know, we often feel like we're just talking to each other, and we think there is a whole community around us, and so it's always appreciated. Even if it just come up and introduce yourself and say, hey, I like your show, that makes my day.
Yeah, most definitely.
Absolutely makes my day.
Yep.
So I am on the web at chambersdaily.com, and I am on Twitter at Bradley Chambers.
And I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter, spears.org on the web, and we'll see you next time.